Good morning. Today we're going to talk about treaties. And following treaties, we'll talk about, and I'm not quite sure which order we'll place this in, economic benefit agreements and co-management agreements, as well as, I don't know how to properly frame this, we'll just call it the business model. Like following, and take a look at, say, Chief Louis's example in Osoyoos, where they've run a whole bunch of community businesses. And we'll look at the Musqueam model, too, which is also one based upon economic enterprise-based community. It's not governance, but it's an economic model of development that provides a type of economic independence, which then potentially allows for certain types of political clout in the ongoing debates, practices of communities. So those are the things we'll be following up and looking at. There's two books that are of kind of interest about the issue of treaties and land claims, and one of them, which I'm going to draw a little bit from today, Treaty Talks in British Columbia, Negotiating a Mutually Beneficial Future by Christopher McGee. It's kind of, let me rephrase that. It is a short summary of the process, the current process, a little bit of the history. It's not particularly critical. It's not particularly laudatory. It's just a handy kind of primer on the treaty process contemporarily. An earlier book that's a bit more hard-hitting and actually lays things out, I think, in a both a harsher and a more comprehensive fashion, but it predates the BC Treaty Commission, is called After Native Claims by, I always call them Cassidy and Dale, the last names of the two authors, and I always forget which one's Norman and which one's Frank. But Cassidy and Dale, at any rate, are the two last names of the author, After Native Claims, published by the delightfully named Ulican Press. And the reason I say Ulican, I don't know, has anyone ever had Ulican? One, two, the rest of you are totally deprived, and it's too bad I couldn't do something to remediate that fact. Ulican are one of the most delicious coastal fish that you can find. They are very, very oily. When fried at a hot, high flame, they tend to be surprisingly delicate, and if you do them just right, you have this nice, crispy outer skin, and then this beautifully delicate fish inside, in which you eat bones, guts, and all. Most of us do. Some people don't. And also dried, smoked, and, of course, turned into that classic commodity of grease. And there are all kinds of different opinions about which grease is best and where is the best grease. But nonetheless, there has been a process occurring over the 20th century of a change in taste. Some of the old timers I talk to say that we don't let the fish ripen enough these days. By ripen means you put it in these great big bins and you let it rot and ferment and percolate, and then you boil it, and you then bite to render the grease off, and you scrape the grease off. Some places actually clarify it. Some people were taking hot, heated stones and drop into the grease. Some places don't clarify the grease. But it's an amazing thing, and for my palate, some of the nicest I've seen, now this is a subjective evaluation, I assure you, comes out of Camano. Of course, Camano's having problems because they're running the water too fast. There's all kinds of water being diverted into the stream, etc. But it's a very, very clear and light flavored grease. Often the Nass River grease, for example, tends to, depending upon who does it, it tends to be a little bit stronger in flavor and taste. But again, it depends how long you ripen it. And some elders have suggested, 4 or 5 weeks or longer is really optimum versus the kind of 2 weeks that you get in some of the more contemporary processes. Anyway, Ulican Press. You probably won't forget the name of the press now. I don't know if it still exists or not. It may have been absorbed by Harbor Press or one of these ones, small local. They used to publish up in Seashell, somewhere in there, called After Native Claims. It's very detailed. And the one thing that strikes me that I always remember in that book when talking about the fisheries and the natural resources, that it's basically, when, this is my paraphrase, keeping in mind it's probably been 15, 20 years since I've actually read the particular line in question, but it goes something like this. Given the state of resource stocks at the present moment in time, any new allocation will be a reallocation of current resources, i.e. there's a fixed pot, and this is what drives much of the big push against resource-based treaties with First Nations communities, is a recognition that this is not an act of creating new things to allocate in the treaties to different communities, but it's taking the current existing pool of fish, timber, mineral resources, water resources. Apparently our government just sold a humongous amount of water to Nestle's for like $2 for several million liters of pine or something. Anyway, just in a little aside. They're apparently taking it out of the aquifer. Sorry, I got distracted myself with that one. But the point being that in any of these settlements, it's allocating current resources. And for some of the resources that have been depleted to such an extent, it means a massive scaling down for the non-Indigenous sector if titles and rights are recognized or land claims are achieved in a way that would be fair and just. So that's what Cassie and Dale had to say about this. Later on, I'll also mention to you, Michael Ash has a book, I think, I forget exactly what its title is, that took issue of treaties. And the one point that Ash makes in his book, which is something to keep in mind, is he says, when he went back to Treaty 4, which is a little bit further to the east, at non-BC, and he examined all the notes that were taken at the time the treaty was done. And what he realized is that the actual government negotiators at the time were quite sincere in treating with Indigenous communities as nations. And what's happened, of course, and what they were actually engaged, and in fact, much of what they were writing down in their notes and observations are what the community members today, for example, in Treaty 4, remembered as being offered to them, except in the intervening century and a half or so, the government's interpretation of what the intent was and the interpretation of the treaty has shifted to a far more diminished understanding of the treaty documents. So Ash is doing an interesting thing by trying to, say, go back and look at these early treaties to see what were the intents of the treaty makers, and then what does it say that the official understandings on the government side of these treaties have shifted over time? What does it say about the capacity of the Crown to maintain its appropriate relationship, the honor of the Crown? And he says part of what's happened is that there's been a willful forgetting on the part of the people who negotiated the treaties. An interesting idea, we'll talk about that later on. We'll pull off a little bit more of that the specifics from Michael Ash's book. And then we'll also look at, a little bit later on, T.A.K. Alford's critique of treaties as essentially an out-and-out sellout and a waste of time. And that's a simplification of what Alford said. Alford is a political science Indigenous scholar at University of Victoria from the east part of Canada, and has written a number of interesting books that argue for a direct traditionalist-based form of sovereignty that's premised upon one's land and one's cultural traditional practices. So we'll look at Alford's critique of this as well. Okay. But for today, we're just going to take a look at BC's treaty process, ask this question, or consider the question, why treaties? Of course, I always say when I do research and methods type thing, why is the absolutely dumbest question to ask? Really, you should be asking how is something done. there are moments when you ask people why, but the why question often spins around in a kind of intriguing domain that doesn't actually get to what's happening. Of course, it also is that I use it here as this kind of existential question of, you know, you might say, why treaties, why not something else? But here I want to try to look at some of the explanatory frames that both government and First Nations leaders have advanced for the reason that treaties are put forward as one avenue of redress to the issue of Indigenous needs. And we'll also just mention that part of this is the Crown, in 1763, the British Crown, which represented British Columbia and the British domains here, actually entered into a treaty with First Nations and issued a number of different treaties and issued a royal proclamation, the Royal Proclamation of 1763, that basically said any expansion in North America required settling, entering into a treaty with the Indigenous nations. Now, one of the reasons why the British Crown wanted to do that is they were very interested in constraining a group of unruly colonists living on the eastern seaboard of North America. Do we know who those unruly colonists were? I'm speaking from the perspective of the British Crown, of course. Sorry? No, well, they were, but no, they just basically beat the French by that point in time. They'd taken control of all of North America, and the famous battle on the Plains of Abraham, et cetera, et cetera. Unruly colonists? Sorry?
We just keep thinking of colonies.
Yeah. Yes, yes, thank you. The 13 colonies in the eastern seaboard, what eventually became the United States of America. Where the British Crown was very, very concerned that the local colonists were extending their economic base and wanted to constrain them beyond, not to go past what is the Alleghenies and those mountain range in that area. And so part of what was going on was a legal maneuver to constrain colonial governments that were trying to break away from the British Crown. And of course, by 1776, you get the Declaration of Independence, you get a rather nasty war in which the British lose in that area, and you see a reshifting of the geopolitics in North America. Interestingly enough, that Royal Proclamation did entangle the Americans' understanding or legal system. Though they did forcibly relocate, take land, and it wasn't until the so-called Marshall decisions, not our Marshall decisions of recent years in New Brunswick with the Mi'kmaq, but Justice Marshall in the U.S., who created the formulation that became called in the U.S. this kind of dependent sovereign nation status, which created a sequence of how in which the indigenous communities in the U.S. then had this idea that they were a sovereign nation, but they were dependent, and so i.e. international affairs, military affairs were run by the U.S. That was in the early 1820s, had to do about Jeffersonian land grabs, etc. It wasn't really a perfect solution, but it created part of the legal history in the U.S., and it had implications in Canadian history. Anyway, oftentimes when the Royal Proclamation is discussed, it's only discussed in its context that it was a recognition of the Crown had entered a treaty with Indigenous nations in North America. I think understanding its context, that it wasn't because the Crown saw there was a great benefit for entering into treaties. What they were interested in was the geopolitical control and the containment of their own enemies. And because they had entered into treaties with some of the indigenous nations to their advantage, they saw the need to do that. It gave them a tactical advantage in their strategic struggles in North America. So we'll explore this idea of why treaties. We'll take a look at the history of the current process, how we got to where we are today, and then consider some of the current outcomes of this process. So, on this question, I've outlined to three ideas for why, three explanatory models. If you go to the BC Treaty Commission, you'll see there's, I believe they have four explanations. And I can't, for the life of me, recall what they listed as their fourth one. Three of these correspond to them. I think these are the three most relevant ones to consider for part of the reason why we have a treaty process. So, in historically speaking, we have, to a certain extent, and the courts have documented, so this ties into the legal one, but the Royal Proclamation obligates the Crown to enter into treaties with First Nations, with Indigenous communities. It obligates the Crown to figure out some way to reconcile Aboriginal law and existence with the Crown sovereignty. And so from the Canadian government's point of view, it's about reconciling it first of all includes the Crown has sovereignty. The Crown is the paramount owner of all the land, but there is an outstanding issue that needs to be redressed and dealt with, and that's the reconciling of Indigenous existence into this fact that we had a 1763 proclamation that encumbered the Crown in such a manner that it had to enter into treaties. But then we have in British Columbia this whole historical context of abject denial and refusal to accept the fact of the Aboriginal rights and title. So the short kind of Coles Note history of this is that James Douglas, governor of the Hudson Bay Company and then the governor of the Crown Colony of British Columbia, enters into a number of treaties in southern parts of Vancouver Island, which are today called the Douglas Treaties. And he began a process of trying to extinguish rights or gain access for the expansion of Victoria, accessing natural resources such as coal around different parts on the coal, timber, fish, etc., opening up land for settlement and agriculture to feed the growing colony, these type of things. But his kind of a model was really short-lived, and basically by the time British Columbia developed its own freestanding legislative assembly, the people who control that legislative assembly are not interested in entering into agreements with Indigenous peoples. And by 1771, when British Columbia becomes part of Confederation, there is a very clearly articulated provincial doctrine that Aboriginal rights and titles, or whatever, the Aboriginal people really have no rights to the land. And the only rights to land or resources is that which the Crown would grant them. And that model pretty well runs all the way through to about 1990. It just, I mean, there's ups and downs and different opinions and things, but by and large, the whole approach in British Columbia, it was resistant and reluctant, and when what they didn't deny, they deferred, and it would put off and drag their heels. So it really wasn't until Bill Vanderzam, the rather flamboyant and intriguing last effective leader, there was a leader that came after him, of the Social Credit Party, grasping for his straws to keep his government afloat, actually entered into an agreement where he'd start to set up a treaty commission with the First Nations and start to recognize the process. His party, the Social Credit Party, just as a quick check here, who's familiar with the title Social Credit? One? Dare you risk a brief description? You've heard the term, but you're not. Okay. So social credit, how do you say it? BC politics are an interesting place. We've always had some kind of really left group, though today we don't. I have to confess. I don't think we do today, but I'll just leave that aside. But our politics have almost in British Columbia at the provincial level sorted in two diametrically opposed positions. Now, back in the 1900s, 1910s, there were four or five people got elected under a Socialist Party of British Columbia ticket. One a snarky labor historian referred to them as the impossibilists or the one plank platform because they basically argued they ran on a worker should overthrow the bosses, and that was their platform. They refused to argue for anything else. But they became very good local MLAs and did lots of hard work. And so they 4 or 5 of them kept getting elected in Trail, and this, I think it was maybe Esquimalt, but up in Nanaimo, a few places. Anyway, all the way run through to the early 1950s, or actually 1930s in Alberta, you get Bible Bill Aberhardy, who's talking this kind of social credit, a beautiful simplicity. A plus B equals C. That's his math. And what that means is you give money to the people, they spend it, it builds the economy. Now, this is not a left-wing version. It's a right-wing version of building things. It's all based on individual investment in the economy. So Bible Bill, who had a radio station and had this model, basically said, here's how you build the economy. Put money in people's hands, they spend it, that generates more money, people get more money in their hands, then they do more spending, and boom, boom, boom. I think it's really, my economist colleagues will probably suggest to me it's not really a good theorem, but it certainly had appeal. And in 1952, in BC's one and only attempt at a preferential balloting system, so you might where people could sort of identify, highlight which groups to go. W.A.C. Bennett, a then car salesman and erstwhile real estate developer, who had fallen in love with the Bible Bill Aberhardy's model, actually won the election because the social credit became everybody's, as the subsequent analysis showed, everyone's second choice. So the mainstream party of the right, the kind of liberal conservative amalgamation, their second choices was the social credit. And the CCF, which is the predecessor of the New Democratic Party, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation folks, they all chose the populist working man's right wing version as their second choice versus the corrupt elite establishment right wing. And we've got W.A.C. Bennett, subsequently referred to as Wacky Bennett by those both friend and foe. And one of the first acts they did in Victoria was to basically cancel preferential ballot and bring us back to first past the post. And that kept W.A.C. Bennett and his party in power from 1952 to Dave Barrett's short-lived NDP government in the mid-70s. And then Bennett's son, Bill, came in and trounced Dave Barrett in, I think, 74 or 5, forgetting exactly, 3 years. And right up until the Harcourt government in 91 or 2, the NDP, it was social credit. Social credit was, for most of the 20th century, the right-wing party in power. They talked about themselves as the Free Enterprise Coalition, same language the liberals currently use. So it was a bit unusual for Bill van der Zandt, this interesting emigre from Holland who had built his fortune in real estate and garden shops, and was trying to build what he called fantasy gardens out by Richmond, the Stevenson Richmond exit. He got in trouble with some kind of shady dealings with a Hong Kong realtor, and they were taped by talking bad deals, so he was using influence. He ended up had to leave office. And anyway, end of the story was, he found himself in a meeting hall with a whole range of First Nations leaders and government officials. He's alleged to have said at the end of that thing, he says, put anybody in a room, feed them all day, drum up them all day, you're going to sign anything. I don't know if he ever really said that, but it kind of captures this long period of time, and he agreed that they would go and create a treaty process. Of course, he lost the government. He actually lost his position. Rita Johnson became the stand-in social credit leader who took the SoCreds to utter ignominy, and they disappeared essentially from the political agenda, and the Liberal Party became the new sort of right-wing alternative as the NDP became the provincial government. And then in 1992, Harcourt signed into agreement to the provincial government legislation, the BC Treaty Commission, which is a tripartite arrangement. I jumped over one of my things, but that's okay. A tripartite arrangement that involves the federal, the provincial, and First Nations leadership. And there's a number of commissioners, and they're referred to as the keeper of the process, I think is the term that's used. Keeper of the process. So they sort of maintain this idea, but it really wasn't until the early 1990s the provincial government actually finally agreed to do this. So let's just talk a little bit about economic necessity. Now, under the idea of economic necessity, there's always this term certainty, and I will tell you right off the bat that for me this is a very perplexing and curious term to use in a market economy. But I'll explain. I mean, that's kind of a snarky comment on my part. But let's just imagine this. Capitalism is all about taking a risk. And you take this risk and you might win, you might lose. And so the ideology of a market economy is one of risk taking, and you kind of see how much risk are you willing to accept kind of thing. Well, of course, when certainty is discussed in this frame in the context of treaties, it means they're really talking about certainty of the ground rules, the rules of the game. And what's happened is because of a whole number of legal challenges in the historical process, large-scale businesses and small-scale, for that matter, have come to the realization that as long as Aboriginal claims, Aboriginal rights and title issues are not addressed, we don't really know what the ground rules are. We can sort of get going and do things like the way we think we should, speaking on part of the government and large businesses. But there's always this possibility that something will be disrupted. You might, it takes a long time for court cases to go through the process, but as with the Chilcotin decision, which actually found Aboriginal title lands exist in BC, and then there's a whole sequence of capacities tied to that legal finding, that changes the ground rules. Now you can't just go to the provincial government and the federal government, depending upon your type of projects, and get them to sign off. Now you actually have to engage in some way with First Nations. And the way you have to engage is not clear. So what treaties are argued for, the reason for doing treaties in this case, is that treaties make the ground rules clear. They define exactly which chunks of land an Aboriginal community will have some claim over, some right to be consulted with, some type of impediment for business. So ultimately, certainty in this frame talks about the role the state plays in facilitating the accumulation of profit and the continuation of economic development for the interests that are currently in power. It's tied to this type of maintenance. So even though one might talk about the role that uncertainty plays in market economies, they say we want consistent ground rules. Now, this is my opinion, not necessarily an empirical fact, but it does appear to me that the ground rules are constantly shaped and shifted to be advantageous toward these large corporations. And that the treaties appear as workarounds on what might be a more expansive role of First Nation. Let me rephrase that. So it looks, what the treaties tend to do is not affirm existing rights, but what the treaties do is reduce and constrain the capacity of any potential Indigenous rights and title. Now, for a number of years, the federal government has given up, sort of backed away from demanding that First Nations extinguish all rights, future rights and title to sign an agreement. That used to be part of the deal. But what they focus on is constraining where and what, which parcels of land belongs to the First Nation, which types of resources are going to be harvested under the agreement and which are side agreements. So with the NISCA agreement, which is outside this process, the fisheries component was all outside the core treaty agreement. It was something that had to be negotiated renegotiate every once in a while. You might note that recently, or you may or may not have seen, because there's just a small little news item, mostly bouncing on the northern local print media sources, the NISCA are now introducing property taxes, and they contracted the BC Assessment Authority to go and assess all the houses and businesses and land within the NISCA treaty lands so that a property tax could be assessed. The capacity for the NISCA to actually enact a property tax is embedded within the treaty. And it becomes, in an interesting way, a constrainment of their rights, because if you did have an unfettered Aboriginal title on the lands and property, you could probably determine what a whole range of different types of taxation methods that you could apply. But by having a treaty, it limits it down to say, so it's the type of taxes that they could charge, and whether they derive any kind of royalties from any of the subsurface results. If you read any of these documents, subsurface rights form a very major component of many of these treaties. We don't really have that many to see, but in the negotiating documents. And why are we worried about subsurface rights? Because if you have a fracking facility, you can actually drill down and then drill over. You don't necessarily need to be on the surface of the land that you're extracting your resources from. The same way with some of the hard rock mining that's going, you don't actually need to be on the surface of the land. So if you go through drilling and hard rock, that kind of excavation with tunnels as opposed to open pit, you don't need to have a physical place. You can drill under places. So there's this, the economic necessity model, our argument, I would suggest, is more a reason for why the state would agree to start entering into treaties. For First Nations communities, there really is no true reason to actually agree to constrain one's rights. Except it's that kind of deal. If you want to say you want to go into an auto shop and you're going to buy this used car and you want negotiating, well, you have the attention of the salesperson all the way along until you sign on the line, right? So there's a kind of power there. You can compel their attention. As long as they think you're serious. If the sales rep thinks, well, this guy isn't really going to buy a car. He's just bringing me along. He keeps coming back every week. He's been coming in here for a year and a half. He hasn't bought a thing. Forget that. But there's a kind of reasonable bounds, and this is, in a sense, what the power that occurs is sort of at the moment just before purchase. There's a kind of power that can be leveraged. And in a lot of these negotiations, from a First Nations perspective, the reasons to sign are there's a less incentive to sign than to hold out and try to negotiate, but then that only allows you to go so far. The state, there's a very big economic necessity to ensure that the ground rules are consistent, and they're actually driving toward a kind of international set of ground rules where they've constrained themselves through different types of international and bilateral agreements around through free trade and different types of instruments like that with other countries. So actually, to a certain extent, the Canadian state is inhibiting its own ability for economic freedom within the state, the nation, within Canada. And therefore, when it signs a treaty with the First Nation, say, around resource rights, there's certain things that Canada, even before it gets to the table with the First Nation, has already given away through being a party to some of the different World Trade Organization-type treaties. Then legal grounds. I've touched on this a teeny bit, and mentioned at other different points of time in the course, but because of British Columbia's denial and avoidance of Aboriginal rights and title, and actually it wasn't until the late 60s, around the late 50s when the Indian Act was changed, that you can actually take the government to court over land claims. It was a criminal event under this Indian Act from about 19, the mid, I forget exactly where, in the early 1920s through mid-1950s. So there's a whole period of time where you couldn't take legal action against the state over rights and title. A sequence of courts cases often cited the Calder case, which leads to a recognition of Aboriginal rights and title in a particular manner. You have the patriation of the Canadian Constitution in 1982 from Westminster to Canada, with its famous Section 35 that recognizes and affirms existing Aboriginal rights and title. And then the subsequent number of court decisions that start interpreting what that means. Everything from the duty to consult, focusing on issues on the fiduciary responsibility of the Crown, starting to define particular rights and priorities of Aboriginal practice. And so essentially you get this whole sequence of laws starting to emerge, these judicial decisions that make it more and more necessary for the Crown to actually enter into treaty negotiations as a mechanism to define and constrain the emerging legal rights that are coming out of the court system. So you have these sort of three things. I mean, and to a certain extent, if the Crown had actually, British Columbia had sat right down right at the very beginning and dealt with things, I mean, we'd be talking about different types of issues today. I mean, we'd be talking about interpreting the treaties, what the treaty rights mean, what the different parties understand. And so if you go down to the United States with the treaties that were signed in the 1850s, you're down in Washington State, you had a famous court decision called the Bolt decision, which interpreted the treaty that meant Aboriginal people had a 50% access of the commercial of the fisheries in Washington State waters. And then there was an whole sequence of clarifications of what that meant. So what we'd be doing today would be interpreting the treaty decisions, the treaty agreements, as opposed to actually being in a legal position of where we're being, the government is compelled to do this. Now you see, this is where I kind of jumped ahead. I mean, I get a kick out. I mean, for those of you who may have, for those of us who had the pleasure of seeing Bill van der Zandt in action, irrespective of one's opinions of his politics, there was something beguiling about the gentleman. He just had a knack, and he did. Bill Bennett wasn't quite as charismatic. I mean, he was very efficient at what he did, which was basically provide the opening salvos for the neoliberalization of the British Columbian economy and government. But van der Zandt was kind of interesting, and it was kind of intriguing that he sort of realizes, and of course coming from the conservative viewpoint, from a market economy entrepreneurial perspective, he basically says we have to deal with this or business gets screwed up, we get slowed down, we're going to be embedded in court cases, disruptions on the land, and this has to be solved. Because as we look at the role of British Columbia. So that was kind of interesting, that aspect. And then I mentioned out of this comes the BC Treaty Commission, and it is the agency that's supposed to kind of, as they call it, the keeper of the process, ensure that treaties are moving through the different steps. I've already really spoken about these particular items on this particular slide. But here we have, and we take a look at outcomes. After 22 years, let's see, if we started in 1992, this is 2015, actually it's 23 years, sorry. 59 nations are in negotiation or completed. Now, there's always a slight mathematical problem when we add up things, because some of these nations are alliances of different Indian bands, as registered bands under the Canadian Indian Act. Some of them are sole bands, just one entity. So I seem to recall, what's the number of this? There's probably, in terms of band councils, 120, 130 in BC. I'm not quite sure exactly. But if you just take one example that's included as two nations here, under the 59. So the Allied Simpson tribes is, which is from Port Simpson or Lac Palams, is listed as one. And then there's a group of the Simpson Treaty tribes, which includes Metlakatla, Kitsilas, Kitsimkalem, Gitisu, and Gitgam. Five Simpson communities. And then there is one community, Kekatla, which is not engaged in treaty negotiations. But if we were to do this number, those two groups would have been one group called the Simpson Treaty Tribal Council about 10 years ago. Was one. And you get these changes. In different parts of BC, you'll see different political organizations where sometimes they're grouped together, sometimes they split apart. The reason why the Simpson Treaty Council, or the Simpson Tribal Council was split apart and initially was kicked out of treaty negotiations because the allied Simpson tribes took the federal government to court over fishing rights. And as soon as you start to take the government to court, your treaty negotiations stop. Because that's a violation of your agreement you've made with them. And then that led to a scramble because the other Simpson communities didn't necessarily want to stay, and then wanted to stay in treaty negotiations, and then it kind of splinters and you get these different groupings forming. Anyway. But here we have five treaties. And it's something interesting about them. So Tsawwassen is an urban treaty. Yale is an intriguing one because it's up in the Fraser River. But Yale is sitting in an intriguing zone in the canyon with overlap from a nation to the north and a nation to the south, highly contested. It's an area that in the Aboriginal and Indigenous era would have had community and people coming from all across the Gulf of Georgia and down the river to fish, because the canyon where the Yale is located is a prime location for resource harvesting. And so working out overlaps and conditions, and some First Nations didn't agree with them. Maunooth is on the west coast of Vancouver Island. Lehetetene in the interior. Each one, when you start looking at them, have very unique and particular histories that make it somewhat easier, or there's to settle agreement, or that there is something about them that's compelling for the government to enter into agreements with them. They also tend to be smaller groupings, except for the Maunooth is a slightly larger grouping in terms of political organization. But they tend, like in Tsawwassen, Yale, to be single band council agencies. You then see the three agreements in principle, which means they're still negotiating, they haven't approved them yet, but they're essentially ready to go forward. A group in the Ililiwat area. A lot of work was done there prior to the Olympics to bring them on board, though they're in behind. Comox Valley, which is a major urban growth area on this province, a lot of urban overlap issues as well as some. A lot of the resource stuff in the Comox Valley has been already extirpated. And then Port St. James, which is the big oil and gas area. And it's a kind of interesting space because there's a lot up there. It's mostly treaty area, so this is a bit of an anomaly. So this is the extent, and I haven't listed the NISCA agreement because it didn't begin in the BC treaty process. It began outside that process. Yes? I took that number down off the list that was the BC Treaty Commission and said they were the nations that are currently negotiating or have signed agreements. So that would mean the ones that are suspended, suspended negotiations aren't on that list. So, and as I mentioned last day, very much of the way this particular process has been set up does not in fact lead to a speedy conclusion of deals, especially when the contexts become more complex. So when you get to areas where you might have four or five nations combined together, but over a wide geographic area that's of importance for resource development, like right where all the tankers and LNG tankers, bulk tankers and LNG tankers are going to run through, you find that the First Nations ask for more than the government is interested in providing. They want more controls and more kind of and more resources control over taxes and benefits and resources. One of the things we're going to look at is how other types of agreements, like co-management arrangements, have allowed treaty-like situations without treaties. So that still doesn't preclude the capacity for there being a treaty, but the co-management arrangement actually allows some kind of benefit to accrue and allows things to proceed without having to deal with treaties. So this is where we'll stop today. Tomorrow we're going to pick up. We continue looking at economic benefit agreements, looking at the business model for going forward, looking at co-management agreements as forms of enacting sovereignty potentially on the ground.